little bit of weird music for you. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host, and that music means it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin on this Friday afternoon. Thanks so much for being here with us. We've got a bunch of weird questions gathered from the internet, and we're going to share them with Jimmy, and Jimmy will give us his answers. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense and a whole bunch of other things, and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kellett.
Thank you for being here on this lovely October afternoon. I hope the weather...
Even though it's really August when we're recording this.
Yeah, a little bit of a pre-record going on today. I'm supposed to be in, I don't know because I don't know the future, but today I'm supposed to be in Melville in New Zealand.
Oh, cool.
So couldn't do a live show, so we pre-recorded it. So I hope I'm enjoying Melville, New Zealand right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, me too. I hope you are, but don't go on the white whale hunting expedition from Melville.
No, I will not. I don't know where I was going. I was going somewhere with that. I wonder if Melville was a whaler. I wonder if he ended up in New Zealand. I wonder if the town's named after him because he went there. I don't know.
Quite possibly.
I will ask them when I'm there.
Okay.
Now I've determined that. I won't be giving out the phone number, or if I am, that's just because I made a mistake, because all the questions come from the internet, and they are weird, and lots of great weird questions. As I said, Jimmy also does Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. What will be on the Mysterious World, or what is on the Mysterious World today?
So today we released part one of a two-part look at a mystery from the 1890s. In 1896 and 1897, for a few months, there were a couple of waves of sightings of mystery airships in the United States. And some people in the UFO community think that this is evidence of early alien contact. Other people, skeptics, think that it was all a big hoax. And I'm going to be presenting evidence that it was neither aliens nor a hoax. It was something else.
Oh, good. Oh, all right. Looking forward to that. I will. You know what I just realized, Jimmy? I'm supposed to be October 6th in Melville, but that will be yesterday by the time we... It's a day off
so
there.
You're saying you've become unstuck in time again.
I'm completely unstuck in time.
So it goes.
All right, here we go with some weird questions for Jimmy Akin. In John 10:16, is it possible that Jesus was referring to extraterrestrial life when he said, "And I have sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice."
So the question asks, is it possible? And I can't eliminate the possibility that Jesus knew about aliens and that one day they'll convert to Christianity. So I can't, none of his audience would have known about them, but I can't eliminate the possibility that that's what he meant. But that doesn't mean it's probable. There are, and I also think it's quite possible that, and even with a greater degree of likelihood, that his audience did not know what he was talking about at the time, that this is just something he said and they weren't sure what it meant. But in terms of trying to figure out what it meant, I think we have a pretty good read on what it's likely to mean, because, you know, there have been other interpretations than the one I'm about to propose. For example, in the Mormon community, it's commonly thought that the other sheep he's referring to were Native Americans, people in the Americas, and that Jesus made a visit to the Americas to evangelize them and set up a parallel church in the New World. We don't really have good historical evidence for that, though. What we do have good historical evidence for is something else, and this is something we read about in the New Testament itself, and it's the conversion of Gentile Christians. This is something that's found in all four of the Gospels. All four of them indicate that Jesus had an interest in, and the gospel writers themselves have an interest in Gentile Christians, and do various things in the gospels to set the readers up for the fact that even though Jesus's mission was primarily to the Jews, that it also would pave the way for Gentile Christians coming into the fold. And they do that in various ways. For example, in Matthew's gospel, where Matthew has his genealogy of Jesus, he names four women in the genealogy instead of just tracing the male line. And what multiple women in that genealogy have in common is two things. One, almost all of them are Gentiles. All of them except Mary were Gentiles, or at least appear to be Gentiles. So Ruth was a Moabitess, Rahab was a Canaanite, and Bathsheba was the wife of Uriah, who was a Hittite. So she may have well been a Hittite as well. The other thing that they all have in common is that they're kind of sketchy, or had a reputation for being sketchy in terms of morals. For example, Rahab was a prostitute. Bathsheba seduced King David, and Ruth was a Moabitess who originally worshipped pagan gods. And Mary was an unwed mother, or got pregnant at least before she and Joseph were cohabitating. And by including these women, which is not at all common for ancient Near Eastern genealogies, they normally focus on just the males in an ancestry. Matthew may be signaling, hey, don't dismiss Jesus just because his mom had a sketchy reputation. Other members of the Messiah's line also had sketchy reputations, even though they themselves were may have been blameless. And he also may be signaling that this is Gentiles, that Gentiles have a role in God's plan too, because they're even in the ancestry of the Messiah. So that's one of the things that Matthew may be doing to set up for the emergence of Gentile Christians. But we definitely know that that happened from Paul's letters and from the book of Acts. And I think reading this in the cultural context that would have made sense to the New Testament readers of John's gospel, looking back on the last several decades of Christian evangelization, would be, oh, he's talking about the Gentiles. So even though I think it's a logical possibility, meaning there are no terms that contradict each other,
right.
It would be a logical possibility that he could be referring to extraterrestrials. I don't think that's the most plausible interpretation of the verse. The most plausible interpretation is he's talking about Gentiles who are going to join the Christian fold.
I forgot to say the name of the person who gave us that question. Jared asked that question. And Jared, thank you very much for starting us off for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. This one comes from Jacob. Hypothetically, if there were a global religious catastrophe and all clergy members were killed except one priest, would that priest automatically become the pope? And follow up, if all the clergy were killed, how would the faithful go about rebuilding the church given that there are no priests or bishops left to ordain new members? And then this is from Jacob, and Jacob says, these are plot points I'm potentially looking to include in a dystopian novel I'm writing.
Well, best of luck with your novel. Let's look at these two options in reverse. Suppose that absolutely all of the clergy were killed. So there are no more bishops, no more priests, and no more deacons, because they're members of the clergy too. What could the faithful do as far as rebuilding the church? Well, they could continue it. And the situation of the church would be basically the same as the situation that the church was in Japan after the anti-Christian laws were implemented and priests were expelled from Japan for some time. Basically, they could continue to teach the faith, they could continue to worship God, and they also could perform the sacraments of baptism and holy matrimony, because those are the two that you don't have to be a priest to perform. So they could continue to baptize people, they could continue to have sacramental marriages. But that would be it, because all of the other sacraments require a priest, and to get a priest you need ordination. And if all of the priests have been killed, then there is nobody to do any more ordaining. So the laity would be in a permanently priestless situation in this scenario. God forbid it should ever happen, and I don't expect it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
They might also do a few other things. And by the way, in assuming that all the clergy have been killed, I'm assuming that that applies not just within the Catholic Church, but to all validly ordained clergy. So no more Orthodox priests, no more Coptic priests, no more other Eastern priests who are validly ordained, because otherwise you can just go get ordination from them.
Oh yeah.
Even if they don't convert, you could still validly have a Catholic receive ordination from them. But assuming, and so that's what would happen if there were surviving non-Catholic priests who were validly ordained. But supposing that there's nobody like that, the lay faithful might also do a few things that you might not initially think of, but they might do things, since priests are no longer around, in imitation of what priests did. A lot of people don't know this, but during the Middle Ages, like in the High Middle Ages, you know, a lot of people didn't receive communion at Mass. You received communion typically once a year in a lot of locations. And so lay people would do other things as spiritual devotional acts, including at Mass. And one of the things they did was they would take bread and have a priest bless it, not consecrate it, but just bless it. And during Mass, they would pass the loaf of bread among themselves and tear off pieces and eat that. And it's not the Eucharist because it's not consecrated, but it does draw on the imagery of bread because they got a literal loaf of bread there. And they're doing this as an act of devotion in God's service. That's why they had it blessed. And you don't have to be a priest to bless things. You know, there are a lot of blessings that can be administered by non-priests. And so one thing I could imagine happening in this ceremony is, since people can no longer celebrate the actual Eucharist, they might revive this ancient custom of having blessed bread that they share as a kind of devotional act that's a substitute for receiving the Eucharist. So that's one thing they could do. They also, of course, they'd set up organizational structures because humans need organization, and they'd have liturgical services of, you know, structured ritual services that might very well be modeled after the Mass, but it would be understood this is not really the Mass since we don't have any priests. What, though, about the first scenario where you get one priest who survives, would he automatically become Pope? The answer is maybe. And the answer is going to depend on a couple of things. The first one is whether there is a fundamental difference between the priesthood and the episcopacy. Are priests and bishops fundamentally the same, or are they fundamentally different so that bishops have the ability to do things that no priest ever has the ability to do? And that's an open question. In theology, there have been some situations where you've had judgments that indicate priests are not able to perform ordination, but there have been other judgments where popes have authorized individual priests to conduct priestly ordinations. And so, for example, if you have the abbot of an abbey who's a priest, and there's no local bishops available, and the abbot needs some new priests in his abbey, popes have given permission for abbots to ordain some of their members of their own household to become priests. So this is actually an open question. And it could suggest that even though, as Vatican II says, the fullness of sacred orders is given with the episcopacy, that fullness might not pertain to a fundamental difference between priests and bishops. And if that's the case, then our sole surviving priest would fundamentally be the same as a bishop. And he thus could potentially, if he's the only entity of this nature in the church at the time, well, he would be the highest authority, and you could potentially understand him as you know, he's the bishop now, he's the pope, he's the only one. However, there are complications for that might result in this not happening. One of the complications is there could be a fundamental difference between priests and bishops, in which case he's just not a bishop and therefore not the pope.
Yeah.
So I would say this one is an open question about how it could go. And since you're writing a novel, it could go any way you want.
Good luck with the novel, Jacob. Thanks very much for the question. More weird questions with Jimmy Akin coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Speaking with Deacon. has Deacon Harold Burke Sivers and Mark Griffin discussing strategies that will empower us to announce the gospel of the Lord daily through our words and deeds. You can hear Speaking with Deacon as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTNradio.net/podcasts today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, a little weird music because it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin for this Friday afternoon. And we're awful happy you're here. I'm awful happy about the next question. Sometimes I just look forward to getting Jimmy's answer to a question. And as soon as I saw this one, I was ready to go. Michael asks, is it possible that my dog is actually my guardian angel who is temporarily in the form of a dog?
So again, the question is asking about possibility, not probability. Mm-hmm. And there's no contradiction. I mean, we know angels can assume human form, and there's no contradiction in terms with the proposition angels can assume canine form. Mm-hmm. So on any particular occasion, I can't rule it out that what you perceive as your dog is actually your guardian angel. However, I don't find it at all probable that it's your guardian angel. And I especially wouldn't find it probable over the entire course of your dog's apparent life. Because mm-hmm. when we've seen angels assume human form, it's usually for a short period. They don't tend to, you know, stay in human form for years and live as a human. You know, the angels who assumed human form and visited Sodom in Genesis, they were in human form for like a day or so, maybe.
Right, right.
And Raphael in the book of Tobit is, you know, in human form for a couple of weeks or something like that. But we don't see him doing this for years. And so dogs live years. And consequently, I would find it quite improbable that your dog is really your guardian angel, but it's not a logical impossibility.
Michael, thank you very, very much for that question. You must have a very sweet dog to even think that that dog is an angel.
Or a very fierce one.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Guarding. I didn't think about that. It's right in the title, guardian angel. Noah asks this one. I think about the doctrine of divine simplicity and the afterlife. If God is not made of any parts, what are we going to see when in heaven? Or what is he going to reveal to us if he's so simple?
Well, the beatific vision is an intellectual vision. It's not literally a visual image. Whatever we're going to perceive in image form, and that might not be anything. We might just navigate the afterlife by intuition, you know, where we intuit God and his nature, but we don't really have a mental image corresponding to it. On the other hand, it's possible God will supply us with a mental image, in which case we will perceive whatever God wants us to perceive. And that could include an image that includes parts, because God has used visions in the past where he appeared in the prophet's mental image to have parts. For example, Daniel sees God seated on a throne. And if you don't have parts, you can't be seated on a throne. And presumably the image that Daniel saw and that some other prophets saw was a human image. So it's possible that God will reveal himself to us not simply through the intellectual perception of God that we refer to as the beatific vision, but using some kind of mental image that may depict him as a human or as something else, or may change over time. He may not appear to us just one way.
Noah, thank you for that weird question. Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour and next hour, and this one comes from Susanna. I heard that Lucifer's rebellion was that God revealed the incarnation of the Son, for which he refused to serve a man. Does that mean it wasn't revealed that God is Trinitarian? I'm assuming that because God is omnipresent, the Son is God and is man.
So the Trinitarian nature of God was presumably already revealed to those in heaven, which would include both the angels and the demons. According to the theory that Susanna is referring to, the devil rebelled because Christ, the Son, was going to become human in Jesus, so he would add a human nature to his divine nature, and the devil would need to pay homage to him in as a human, in addition to being God. And he found that an intolerable thought, that human nature is just too lowly for him ever to pay homage to, and therefore that's why he rebelled. But he presumably already knew the Trinitarian nature of God, and it was just the incarnation that of one of the three persons that was what led him to get in a snit. I should say, though, that this is just speculation. This is not a matter of church teaching. There have been multiple speculations about why the devil rebelled, and none of them are definitive. Personally, I'm not particularly wild about this speculation. Mm-hmm. I can't eliminate it, but I think that that it's, well, very speculative, and I don't see it as being well supported as a speculation, so I don't consider it exceptionally probable. Can't rule it out, but it's not my favorite theory.
Susanna, thank you very much for that. This is part of the fun of Weird Questions. We go from Lucifer's fall and its relation to the incarnation to Nicole's question. What are your thoughts on spontaneous human combustion? Is there evidence it's happened? And what would be a possible explanation for it?
Well, there's certainly evidence that a phenomenon referred to as spontaneous human combustion has happened. In fact, I devoted a whole episode of Mysterious World to the topic, and you can find it at mysterious.fm/149, because it's episode 149. So mysterious.fm/149. In terms of the phenomenon itself, well, there are situations where someone has been left alone, and when people came back, there's been a fire, and bizarrely, the middle part of the person's body has been burned, often burned away to where they're just like bones, and the only parts of their body that are untouched are maybe like their hands and their feet. And so you come back and there's this big pile of ash and maybe some bones in it, and then there's a couple of feet sticking out the bottom that are not touched by the flame. In terms of what causes, and this seems to be spontaneous because it was not clear to the people why the fire or combustion happened, and of course it happens to a human, so you put all that together, it's spontaneous human combustion. In terms of what causes it, well, there have been a bunch of theories. There, one that I'm sure is responsible for a lot of these cases is a combination of smoking, alcohol, and old age. Many people who are older have mobility issues. They can't easily get up and move around frequently. You know, they may be confined to a wheelchair or a chair, or they may be, going along with being elderly, they may also be quite obese, which can cause further mobility issues. And sometimes they drink alcohol, and alcohol is combustible. And alcohol can get on your clothing, and it can get into your cells. And if you also are smoking at the time you're drinking alcohol and have mobility issues, you can catch fire, and your clothing can function like the wick of a candle. You know how if you watch a candle, the wick doesn't burn at the same rate as the candle. The wick is fed by the wax or the tallow in the candle.
Yeah.
And so what happens is your body, your clothing catches fire, and then it's fed by the body fat, which functions as if it were wax or tallow, to keep the fire going. And since you don't have a lot of body fat on your feet and hands, that's why it doesn't go there. Also, your feet, if you're sitting in a chair, your feet are down low on the ground, and flame burns upwards. So it's going to consume the upper part of your body, not your feet. And there are multiple cases of spontaneous human combustion where we know someone was elderly and had mobility issues and they were drinking alcohol and they were smoking, and then this happened. So I think this is responsible for a lot of the cases of spontaneous human combustion that have been reported. However, if you listen to episode 149 of Mysterious World, you'll hear me mention, I don't know that it's responsible for all of them. There are reports of people having an obscure chemical process occurring in their body that makes them heat up, bizarrely heat up. And that also could be responsible for some of the cases of spontaneous human combustion, if there's this obscure chemical process that sometimes activates.
Check out episode 149 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, Nicole, and thanks for the question. More weird questions for Jimmy Akin coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour, hence the Weird Questions music. We've got all these questions. They come to us in various ways. People communicate directly with Jimmy, and sometimes they send them to us at our email address, radio@catholic.com, or maybe people find other ways. I don't know all the ways, but when we get them, they get all collected up, and then we asked Jimmy a bunch of weird questions. And this one comes from Steve. What evidence is there that humans matured earlier in life in Christ's time?
Well, I think it's going to depend on what you mean by matured, whether you're talking, for example, about biological maturity or emotional, social maturity. I don't know that they matured biologically any earlier at all in Christ's time than compared to today. You know, puberty hit at about the same time, and an adult was regarded as being an adult at approximately the same time. For example, today, well, in the Old Testament, full maturity seems to be reckoned as happening when you're about 20 years old. So 20-year-olds could be impressed into the military, they could fight battles, they got married, and so the 20 seems to be when people were reckoned as mature then. But And that corresponds to today, where, you know, kind of you're a sort of a legal adult at 18, but certain things are you're not allowed to do until you're 21. But we're still talking about the same age range. And so I don't know that biologically people matured any earlier then than they do now. In fact, if anything, I would suspect it would go the other way around, that people would mature earlier biologically today because we have better nutrition today. And that'll help you mature more quickly, at least potentially. Also, someone told me recently, I think, that the development of or in parts of the world where they have artificial lighting, that that has resulted in females having a slightly earlier onset of puberty than in parts of the world that lack artificial lighting, because the amount of light you're exposed to can affect various biological cycles, possibly including the cycles that are related to puberty in women. I don't know that that's true, but it's what I remember being told. Now, I have not verified it for myself, haven't looked up any studies on that. Having said that, I do think people matured socially and possibly emotionally more quickly back then. Today, we have this thing known as a teenager. And teenagers, the custom of having teenagers really doesn't go back very far. You didn't have this long period between what was considered childhood and when you assumed adult responsibility, where you're kind of sort of a child, but sort of an adult, and you're not really all of either.
Right.
There tended to be there wasn't this extended period of time. There tended to be a period where it's like, okay, you're this age now, you're an adult, go be a man or go be a woman. And one of the reasons for that is because life was harder in the past. Lifespans were shorter, not hugely dramatically. I mean, at least assuming you survived infancy, they weren't dramatically shorter, but they were somewhat shorter. And life was much harder. Mm-hmm. And so people had more responsibility thrust on them sooner. So you didn't have this long period where you get to hang out and have mom or dad pay your bills and you get to play video games for years. That's a newfangled thing. Mm-hmm. And in the past, it's like, okay, you're starting to work as a child. And when you get to a certain age, okay, now you're an adult. Now you can go off on your own if we're in a culture that has small nuclear families as opposed to extended families. And you can get married and you can do all the adult stuff. But you are just expected to suck it up and shoulder responsibility in a way modern teenagers are not.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of the reasons. Also, you didn't have to have super huge, enormous educations the way people do today. So you didn't have to complete high school. You didn't have to go to college. You didn't have to get a postdoc. You didn't have to do any of those things. And so so once you had basic information in a trade, and almost everyone was a farmer, so you learned that growing up, doing your chores. But once you had a basic education, whether it was as a farmer or a merchant or a tanner or whatever it may have been, you could go do your job. And so I think socially and perhaps emotionally, people did mature quicker in the past because they were expected to function as an adult sooner and suck it up and get on with life and behave responsibly.
Steve, thanks very much. Appreciate that question. Weird questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. This one comes from Marianne. What would the moral implications be of joining an expedition to colonize Mars or other planet, knowing that there would not be access to any sacraments indefinitely?
Yeah, that's such a threshold question, isn't it? It's one even might say it's an ad limina question.
Well, thanks, Jimmy. Yeah. I appreciate you saying it that way.
Yeah. I'm referring to the fact that Cy Kellett himself has written a novel about a Mars colony with a bishop.
Yes.
And it's called Ad Limina, and you can get it. It's on Amazon, and you can get it and read it for yourself.
Well, thank you, Jimmy.
In terms of, and ad limina is to the threshold in Latin. So that's why I said it's a threshold question. Well, we can look to history for parallels to this, because this has happened before. in the age of sail, or sometimes called the age of exploration, where the world was being explored by people who went out on wind-powered ships that would sail the seas, using their sails, they would be gone for long periods of time, sometimes years. And the church did not prohibit that. So unless the church did something different this time, it wouldn't establish a law saying no Catholic can immigrate to Mars. What you would need to do practically is, well, stay out of mortal sin and be prepared to make acts of perfect contrition if you're not going to have access to confession for a long time. You also, now you might wonder, well, what about your obligation to receive communion once a year? Well, you would want to do that if you can, but physical impossibility is an excuse. You're not mm-hmm. obliged to do what's physically impossible. So if you can't receive communion once a year, then that law just doesn't apply to you. But what you'd probably do, because this also happened in the age of sail, is you take priests with you. There would be chaplains, and people would take them when they formed a new colony in the new world, for example, or in a Pacific island. And similarly, they'd take priests with them to Mars and set up a chaplaincy to minister to the spiritual needs of the Martian colonists, and eventually they'd have bishops who would be called back to Earth for their ad limina visits.
What a great question. Thanks for asking that. We forget that how long those, well, I don't know, maybe other people don't forget, but those age of sail trips, the long years you could be away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I imagine there will be a space chaplaincy at some point. Marianne, take a space chaplain with you.
There's actually even already a dicastery in Rome for the care of seafarers and other migrants, and it would fall under the same dicastery if you're going to another planet.
Again, Marianne, thanks very much. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll get to more weird questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
Carry the faith wherever you go. Watch the EWTN series, specials, events, and news streaming live from anywhere in the world. Streaming is available on the EWTN app for Apple, Android, and Amazon devices. Download the EWTN app at EWTNapps.com today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having some fun on a Friday afternoon. Jimmy Akin's here, and it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. If you are like, hey, I got a weird question I want to ask Jimmy Akin, you can send it to us. radio@catholic.com is our email address, and we'd love to pass it on to Jimmy and share it with him on the show. Sorry, Jimmy, I thought you were about to say something. You can also check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World at mysterious.fm, or just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World in your machine, and you'll find it. Let's go to Mark's question. Mark asks this. If Christ made a visit to all continents together with Joseph, Mary, and the apostles, just like a papal visit, before he was crucified, would the world have become Christians?
Well, there actually have been claims sort of like that. In the history of religion, for example, I mentioned earlier on the show that Mormons hold that Jesus visited the New World, not before he was crucified in Jerusalem, but afterwards. And there also were claims by some in England that Jesus, possibly accompanied by the Virgin Mary or by Joseph of Arimathea, maybe St. Joseph, visited Britain, the island of Great Britain, either when he was a child during his lost years or some of them may have come back after after the crucifixion. And there are even songs that refer to this kind of thing. There's one called, I believe, Joseph Was a Tinsman, and it is about Joseph of Arimathea being a trader in tin, which the metal tin, which was mined in Great Britain in antiquity. And so that there's this legend that Joseph was in the tin trade and made visits to Egypt. Joseph of Arimathea, not Joseph's Jesus dad. There's also a poem by William Blake, which has been set to music, and it's called On England's Mountains Green. And the lyric from the poem is, "And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? And was the Holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen?" And so it's been a while since I've heard the tune, so forgive me. But, you know, there is this suggestion that Jesus may have visited England. Now, we don't have good historical evidence for any of that. But there have been similar claims to this. And if Jesus, possibly accompanied by his parents or the apostles, visited other areas of the world, you know, did a world tour like a papal visit, would that mean the whole world would have become Christians? Well, if God wanted it to, it could have, but it depends on what he did and where. Merely making a papal visit doesn't make everybody Christian. Yeah. You know, if the Pope goes to Japan, that doesn't mean Japan becomes a Christian nation automatically.
Right.
And that's in the modern world where you have, you know, TV and the ability to have intense news coverage of the Pope's visit to Japan. I mean, people in Japan would be all over that. And sometime, you know, some of them would convert, but it wouldn't just automatically destroy the religious environment in Japan and undo all of the religions that are there right now. So if you then had Jesus visiting locations, you know, with a posse of folks alongside of him, well, a few people in the area would be aware of him and a few people might convert. That wouldn't result in everybody becoming a Christian immediately in that area, although it could accelerate the process of Christianization, so that maybe that country would end up, if it becomes Christian, it might become Christian sooner than it otherwise would have, allowing a lone apostle or group of apostles to reach it later.
Mark, thank you for that weird question. Appreciate it. Seth wants to know this, Jimmy. Did Jesus have opinions, such as having a favorite food or favorite color? Would these be the results of random biology and environment as he grew up?
The answer to both is presumably yes. All humans have preferences, and our preferences are shaped by our biology and by our experiences, by both nature and nurture. I remember seeing a powerful demonstration of this. This was more than 20 years ago, but I was over at the house of some friends who were vegetarian. And so they had a vegetarian meal, and they had two small daughters who at the time were like 1 and 2 years old. And I remember watching the daughters at the meal, like as we're sitting down to eat, the daughters are like reaching out their hands and really anxious and begging for a piece of lettuce. Well, that would not have happened in my household growing up. But it did happen here, because based on the experience that these children had growing up in a vegetarian household, lettuce was one of the most attractive things they had to eat. And so they were all into lettuce. And it was because of their environment as well as their biology. And in the same way, you know, we also have, and I guess I should mention this. We're even programmed. So, you know how, if being a father, Si, you know how there's a stage early on where babies will put anything in their mouth.
Yes.
It doesn't matter what it is, they're going to stick it in their mouth. And then as they get a little bit older, that changes. And all of a sudden, they become really picky eaters.
Yes. It's like crazy.
Yeah. It's like a window closes and they'll have a very restricted diet. It's like all macaroni and chicken nuggets from here on out for a few years. Well, there's a reason for that. The reason for that is humans are a global species. And so we live all over the planet, and not all the same plants are available everywhere, and plants and animals are available everywhere on the planet. So biologically, you got a baby in the womb, it doesn't know where it's going to grow up. It doesn't know what's going to be available to eat. It's not like a koala. You know, koalas grow up in eucalyptus trees, so that's what they're designed to eat. They don't really care about anything else. It's just, give me that eucalyptus, because that's where they're going to grow up. They're going to grow up in eucalyptus groves. Well, humans don't do that. Humans grow up all over the place, and there's no predictable, from the unborn baby's perspective, there's no predictable way of knowing what's going to be good to eat. And so babies need to be born with an openness to whatever's available. And they will stick anything in their mouths. But that needs to not continue for forever. Because if it continues forever, when they're no longer being immediately supervised by their parents, they're going to poison themselves.
Yeah.
So they need to be open to eating anything under their parents' supervision. But then that openness needs to go away, so that they don't end up poisoning themselves when their parents are no longer supervising them. And thus, we are biologically programmed to become picky eaters, where after we've identified this is the stuff we have available to eat that's good for us, that's all we want to eat, because anything else might be unsafe. And so this is a biologically programmed aspect that depends on local culture and local environment. So there, we see this interplay of the biological programming with the local environment. And the same thing would have applied to Jesus. So, this is also why we like foods we grew up with and are suspicious of foods that we didn't grow up with. So Jesus, growing up, would have eaten lamb. You know, is ate every Passover at least, and probably more often than that. So he would, based on his openness to food initially, Mary and Joseph would give him lamb, he'd eat the lamb. Then when the window closes, it's like, okay, I'm eating lamb, but not pork. Because pork was not part of his early socialization. So he would have preferred lamb to pork. He might have recognized intellectually that pork is made by God too, and so it's not really unclean in an objective sense, but it would not have been his preference because he didn't grow up eating it. So yes, Jesus would have had preferences or opinions, as Seth puts it, and these would have been formed by both his biology and his environment.
Seth, what a great question. Thank you very, very much for that. This next one is about George C. Scott. Do you happen to remember George
Day of the Dolphin?
The Day of the Dolphin, yeah. That movie freaked me out when I was a kid for some reason. If an animal, let's say a dolphin, were artificially made more intelligent, like to a human level, would that dolphin be able to be baptized? Would it be basically a human with regards to the afterlife? If not, what change would be required to make an animal into a person? How would this be the same or different from a scenario where we discover intelligent space aliens?
Okay, so a person is the classic definition is a person is a rational substance. And so if it has human level reason, it would be a person. So that's what you need to make a dolphin or anything else a person. You need to give it human level reason, or at least approximately human level reason. And there's actually, this is a concept that's been explored in science fiction. I believe it's David Gerald, who is the author of the Uplift series. And I may be wrong about the name of the author, but there's a science fiction series known as the Uplift series, which is about taking other species and endowing them with human level intelligence, which is a process known as uplifting. And this, it turns out, is the normal process of how you get intelligence in the galaxy. And so when we get discovered, humans get discovered by aliens, they assume we've been uplifted, that we didn't naturally evolve this way. Someone uplifted us, some rogue agency uplifted us. And then we've also uplifted like chimps and dolphins and things like that. So that's part of what drives the plot is, no, actually, we were not uplifted. We just evolved this way. Let's proceed to our second question, since we've answered what would it take to make a dolphin a person or another animal a person, needs human-level intellect. Would it be able to be baptized? Well, this is an open question, and the church has not definitively settled this. I have an episode that deals with a lot of these types of questions, although with extraterrestrials rather than uplifted dolphins. It's episode 55 of Mysterious World, so you can go to mysterious.fm/55 to hear about the principles that would be involved in this. But to make it short, if the dolphin asks to be baptized, I would say you can baptize the dolphin. If it feels a need to be baptized, like a need to be forgiven its sins, or just a need to be in union with Christ in his mystical body, if it feels a need to be baptized, I would say that's evidence it has a need to be baptized, and therefore it would be legitimate to baptize it to fulfill that need. What about its afterlife? Well, if it's the classical analysis would say that if it's got a rational soul, so it's got human level reason, then that rational soul will survive death and it'll have an afterlife. However, it is not church teaching that a rational soul is needed to have an afterlife. And a while back, I did an episode of Mysterious World on animal afterlife. It's episode 203. So you can go to mysterious.fm/203, where I went through the arguments in the classical analysis about you got to have a rational soul to survive death. And I concluded they ain't persuasive. These arguments do not remotely prove what they're trying to prove. And I also conclude we actually have evidence that at least some animals have an afterlife. And I won't spoil what that evidence is, but it's actually been studied in a particular branch of science. And so if you want to know about what evidence we might have that animals, or at least some animals, do have an afterlife, check out episode 203. So I would say whether or not the dolphin is given human level intellect, it may already have an afterlife.
Thanks, Chris. Great question. Check out the movie Day of the Dolphin. Do you think you have time to do Partenio's question, Jimmy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's short.
Partenio asks this, what happened to the holy prepuce?
So this is a term a lot of people aren't familiar with in English, but in males, a prepuce is basically a foreskin. And there were claims, I gather, at least I've heard there have been claims, I haven't ever verified this, that Jesus's foreskin was displayed as an ostensible relic in the Middle Ages. It's like, here we've got Jesus's foreskin, and so, you know, it's part of Jesus, so let's venerate it. Problem is, I find this extraordinarily unlikely. They did not save foreskins in the ancient world. You know, among other things, they didn't have refrigeration. Of course, they could have, if you have a piece of skin from someone, you could tan it or dry it out, but they just didn't save foreskins in the ancient world. At least we have no evidence of ancient Jewish people saving foreskins. So the expectation and the probability would be that they would have done with Jesus's foreskin what they would have done with any other foreskin and just thrown it out. So even though there have been alleged displays of a holy prepuce, I find it very unlikely that any of them are authentic.
Partenio, closed that hour with a pretty weird question, so thanks very much for that. It's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin. And we're going to continue with it next hour. And we got plenty more weirdness to come. I'm actually glad that one's out of the way. We move on to the second hour. Jimmy, I'll see you in a couple minutes.
Okay.
Right back with more weird questions.